Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. This is Friday, November 28th, and this is Jeff Dunphy, and our show is called Retooling for Our Coming of Age, coming to you from a very frosty Calgary, Alberta. We're going today to review the economy. We're going to review some memes, M-I-M-E, of economic realities versus economic propaganda. We're going to chat a little about the American economy and the global economy and the concept of, are things getting better or are things getting worse? I would like to review a wonderful commentary that most people know, and it is, one of the definitions of insanity is doing the same thing and expecting things to change. In the course of my business teaching career, I have on occasion spoken of how the thought of doing something silly is not readily apparent on the front end of its exercise. For example, if we do jump off a cliff, and we now have the opportunity to watch the YouTube individuals jumping off cliffs and soaring like birds while they're plummeting at the speed of gravity, we have an opportunity to jump off a cliff and look upon the horizon as not moving. And we're flapping our arms, thinking or deluding ourselves into thinking that we are flying. And there is a place or a point in time where the participant goes, oh my, no more am I flying than I'm plummeting at the speed of gravity, which is 10 meters squared. So 10 meters per second squared, forgive me. So consequently, you are plummeting to Earth, and you are thinking, my goodness, and you start to flap ever harder. And this sounds a little bit like a cartoon, and it's certainly the cartoons that I watched as a kid, the Roadrunner and the Wile E. Coyote, where you are suspended in midair until you realize that you are going to plummet and collapse. And I suspect, nay, I would rather think, that there will be a point in time when people will recognize that things not only are not getting better, but they, within the current confines of the system, haven't the capacity to get better. So we are plummeting to some sort of sense of collapse. And as Rick Rule points out, it's called capitulation, where people just throw up their hands and go, we're done, we're out of here. Now we're looking at a Dow Jones Industrial Average index that has never been higher. And we're looking at it as a manipulated scenario. We're looking at many of the big banks who used to be in the commodities trading business getting out of that because the scrutiny about their integrity has reached such a fevered pitch that everybody recognizes and knows that these market makers, as they have been named and called, are market manipulators. So they can effectively do with the market whatever they see fit. Now I want to chat a little about and bring you up to speed on some of the economic factors that have happened in this last little bit. We were witness to the American Thanksgiving yesterday and the markets were closed. This is a very relatively slow part of the season, and there's an aspect of slowing down over the Christmas season where economic activity, trading activity, general news has a tendency to make the traders skittish, if you will. So overnight news, I mean, we have seen the price of oil drop from north of $110 to it's trading at around $69 right now. Now, why is that important? Why should we pay attention to that? And why do we need to care about the price of oil? Because the instant response is, great, gasoline for our car is going to become cheaper, which it is, but ironically, if the price of oil goes from 110 to 69, the price of gas doesn't go from 110 units of money to 69 units of money. It usually goes from 110 to 100. There's some stretch in there. But why should we care if the price of oil goes down? Well, on the upside, or on the promotional side, or the propaganda side, you have a whole bunch of countries that are reliant on the revenues that present themselves to the country via their sale of oil. So they will take a certain percentage of the oil revenues as to help run their country. And at the beginning of the year, they look at things and they forecast and they say, well, what's the price of oil and what are we going to spend to keep our economy where it is? What are our public policy and our economic policies that we need to spend in order to, one, and this is the true reason, in order to make sure that our constituents are happy with us and they keep us in power? And two, how is it that we're going to be in a place where the money that we spend gets spent in a manner that is productive and creative and promotional of a healthy economy? Now, that being said, most of these countries say, okay, well, we see right now that the price of oil is $110 or $112 or $109. Let us budget accordingly and let us spend money accordingly and let's tell our constituents that we are going to do this. Imagine what happens with these upper-level government officials when they look at their revenue stream as being cut by $110 to $69. So, I mean, that's $40. That's $40. So it's, you know, in the mid-30s percentage. So all of a sudden, they won't be able to meet their economic expenditures. So they'll either have to borrow, but they'll have to borrow from people who will lend the money thinking, well, you're heavily reliant on oil, so consequently, I don't know whether I will want to lend to you. Okay. So even though the drop in the price of oil lends itself to less expensive fuel and less expensive commodities, it also lends itself to businesses making decisions based on the current pricing and making decisions based on their costs. Imagine, if you will, that it costs you $10 a barrel to get a barrel of oil out of the ground, and you can sell it for $110 a barrel. Wow, that's terrific. Then you get $100 a barrel. But imagine, if you will, that it costs you $80 a barrel to get a barrel of oil out of the ground, and the price goes to 70. Well, now think about that for a minute. You pay 80 to get it out of the ground, and you turn around and you can only sell it for 70. What do you do? Well, obviously, you just say, well, I'm not going to produce that barrel of oil. It's just too expensive. Now, there's lots and lots of oil in the world. However, the issue isn't how much there is. The issue is how expensive is it to get it out of the ground? Well, as I said, if it's going to cost you $80 a barrel to get it out of the ground and you're only getting paid $70, you don't want to pull it out of the ground. In no time at all, you're going to bankrupt yourself, right? So part of what happens when this kind of stuff happens, all the people that get together that produce oil, the most significant cabal of these is called OPEC. And even though they are far less significant than they were earlier in the last 50 or 100 years, they get together and they make noise about, well, we might cut production, because one of the reasons the price of oil goes down, thank God, is that its oversupply is such that people are prepared to pay less for it because there's lots of it around. And as a country evolves, it goes, well, we can't afford to not sell our oil, we still need to generate revenue. And in various places, Saudi Arabia, Libya, Iran, Iraq, there's all kinds of oil that they can produce for less expensively. In Canada, we produce oil out of the oil sands, the tar sands, at $60, $70, $80 a barrel. So when the price is $110, that's okay. When the price is $70, there's serious upset and concern. So now, when the price of oil drops, you have an enormous amount of countries looking at things going, heavens to flipping Betsy, what are we going to do? That's legitimate. Imagine, if you will, that your paycheck gets cut by 40-35%. You'd go, well, just a second, I budget according to my paycheck and here's what I'm going to do. And consequently, that would put us in dire straits. So now let's play in the world of trading. In the world of trading, we have stock market players, we have stock market traders, we have the manipulators, as we have spoken in this show over and over and over again. And we have them saying, well, what does the drop in the price of oil do to various countries now? So then they start to play with what is represented in the capital markets by those particular countries. Canada, for instance, is viewed, whether it's true or not, but it is viewed in the capital markets as being a very commodity-based economy. And so consequently, with the drop of the US dollar, with the drop of crude oil prices, everybody starts to dump Canadian dollars. So Canadian dollars relative to US dollars drop in strength. Right. So you've had an interesting watch on all of this stuff, right? When you see a dramatic drop of commodity prices, you see trading change the very fabric of how people sit. It was a very short period of time that the Canadian dollar was trading at par with US dollar. It's now trading at 15% below the US dollar. So which means, for those of you who walk into a bank, you say, I would like to buy $100 of US currency. And the bank says, okay, that will cost you $115 of Canadian currency. Now, you have countries dancing with each other because they're paying attention to the groups that define how everything unfolds in the world stage. Now, because the Americans have been able to tell everybody what and how to do it for so long, there is an interesting aspect of what's unfolding right now. A short period of time ago, the Americans said they would slow down quantitative easing. However, in the same breath, it would appear as if they said to the Bank of Japan and the European Central Bank, we want you to start printing more and more money, because what we want to do and facilitate is a continuation of the quantitative easing to flood the world with fiat currency, but we want to flood the world less with US currency, and we want to flood the world more with Japanese yen and euros. To which they all went, okay, fair enough, that's there you go. So the Japanese yen, the Bank of Japan said they were going to print money till hell wouldn't have it, and we are going to, and the same with the European Central Bank, Mario Draghi saying the same thing, right? So I want to read a quote to you, which I found quite funny this morning in reading one of my newsletters. Concerning the Canadian dollar's weakness, we shall, of course, blame it upon the notion, not the fact, but the notion that Canada is primarily a commodity-related country and that it is too dependent upon oil from the oil sands, which is what we just discussed. We are of the mindset that is far too simplistic and badly wrong, but we are also cognizant of the fact that the market is larger than are we, and that the market's collective bet is in opposition to our view. We are reminded here this morning of Keynes' brilliant statement that the market can remain illogical far longer than we can remain solvent. I think that's a brilliant quote. And we do indeed think that the market's bet against the Canadian dollar is illogical and wrong, but betting against that collective decision is, for the moment, ill-timed and also wrong. Okay, there we go. So part of the very fabric of the marketplace is it oftentimes doesn't make sense. In watching a market capitulate, in watching the traders withdraw, or watching the traders just simply give up, it creates enormously violent price moves. And generally speaking, it creates enormously violent price moves downwards. Just as the stock market crash in October of 29, just as the stock market crash in 87, just as the stock market crash in 08, when the financial system in and of itself was put into peril, there is an imminent stock market crash about to happen. It isn't a function of if anymore. It is a function of when. Okay? Now, we have seen economic sanctions against Russia by the collaborative approach of the Europeans and the States that has made Russia's ruble drop like a stone, and it's collapsed effectively. It's fallen by 40%. Now, that collapse, as Jim Rickards is wont to point out, is an actual act of financial war. He was once involved in the war games that didn't use bombs and bullets, but used financial instruments. Most people don't get and understand how that actually can be done, and the whys and the wherefores of it. And Jim Rickards has written a couple of books that are absolutely brilliant that I would bid you find and read, should you so see fit, because part of the impetus of this program and part of the intent of this program is to create an environment where you can make sound decisions, fiscal decisions, economic decisions, and literally even physical decisions about where you're going and what's up relative to the economy, and start to realize that the economy in and of itself is run by a whole bunch of people who are incredibly self-serving. And I think you don't have to look very far to realize that the shepherds of the economy are incredibly promotional of their own interests, okay? And I want to park you in this mindset for a moment, okay? What separates successful states from failed ones is whether their governing institutions are inclusive or extractive. Now, this, again, brings us back to one of our productive, positive, real, true memes, and as go we, so go I. Extractive states are controlled by ruling elites whose objective is to extract as much wealth as they can from the rest of society. Inclusive states give everyone access to economic opportunity, and often greater inclusiveness creates more prosperity, which creates an incentive for even greater inclusiveness. As go we, so go I. Now, that, when one thinks of it, makes imminent sense. If you can create, there's one of the memes, and certainly one of the economic experiments that has happened over the last 100 or 200 years, is that the collective state, socialism, or in all fairness, communism, the jury's out. It didn't work. However, I would care to propose that it isn't so much that the state rules things. It is so much that everybody is left to their own devices. And when they know that their collaboration in terms of doing things better for themselves is contributory to the economy, it is beneficial. This would be Adam Smith's invisible hand. But what has happened is that that has been perverted, not into what is in my best interests, threatens everybody else's. And the game being played now is zero sum. If I have to gain, somebody else has to lose, rather than everybody winning. The win-win scenario is no longer viewed as viable in this perverted system. So the ideal, the utopia, if we will, would be to have everybody who has a specific talent following their talent, or as Joseph Campbell is wont to say, following their bliss. And so if you are a wonderful businessman and you sell widgets, you go about and you make these widgets and you provide the service that these widgets are contribute to the economy, and everybody says, we will pay you a certain unit of money, and everybody prospers. The baker prospers, the butcher prospers, the blacksmith prospers, whatever. Everybody lives in a society where everybody contributes to it and everybody benefits as a result of collectivism. But what does tend to happen is that we have a banking system that gets caught up in its own self-empowerment and its own self-aggrandizement to the detriment of everybody else. Now, the banking institute, think about this, right? When you go to the bank and you put money in the bank, it's your money that you put in the bank. But what does a bank do? It says, for you to have your money in this bank, we are going to take your money from you. We're going to charge you whatever. I had one bank account that was charging me $1,000 a year to run. Now, how ridiculous is that? Now, there are other banks where, in fact, I moved bank accounts because that bank account was free. It did not charge you anything to have money in it, which is ridiculous. Ridiculously good versus the banking system here. Now, I want to give you a quote from that is in keeping with where we're going with this line of thinking. Our freedom of choice in a competitive society rests on the fact that if one person refuses to satisfy our wishes, we can turn to another, which is what I just did in the banking gig. But if we face a monopolist, we are at his absolute mercy. And an authority directing the whole economic system of the world would be the most powerful monopolist conceivable. It would have complete power to decide what we are to be given and on what terms. It would not only decide what commodities and services were to be available and what quantities, it would be able to direct their distributions between persons to any degree it liked. Brings us to the old statement, power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. So when we play in a commodity-based system, when we play in a monopoly-based system, where people can decide to who and what their largesse is directed. We have extractive societies, okay? And that gives us great pause for all of this stuff. And we are in this place of having to pay attention where the bankers are. Now, I want to get back to the banking industry. The banking industry in and of itself is a very extractive industry, and it provides no service whatsoever. It is an intermediary. And it is an intermediary in that the banks actually charge you to have your money in their banks. How silly is that? Why don't you just keep it under the mattress? Then it's free to use as you see fit. There are negative interest rates going on right now because the economy is on the bones of its ass to such a fashion that charging anybody any interest right now would be a huge anchor on the economy. And the policymakers know that. Okay? So we are now in this place where the economy in and of itself is being compromised by the banking industry. Now, I want to read you something that I've recently found that is it makes you laugh, but it also is one of those reminders that everything is the same, just like it was before. I mean, that aspect of history that you do not know, you are destined to repeat, I think was Churchill's representation of that little vignette. So this is written by a guy named Jeff Nielsen, and it was written a couple of days ago, or maybe 10 days ago. So in previous commentaries, readers have seen scoffs of derision with respect to arguably the two most important propaganda myths of the 21st century. These are what I've made reference to over and over and over again as memes. The new normal and the new world order. So the gist of that criticism is that we rarely see anything truly new in our lives in conceptual terms. The declaration, through propaganda and or disinformation, that we have two all-encompassing new paradigms which supposedly comprise our current reality is patently ludicrous on its surface. Context changes, principles are immutable. The new normal is nothing but a lie of the corporate media designed to supposedly justify the fact that the lives of the masses are getting steadily worse every day, while the lives of the privileged get steadily better every day. Remember, we talked about exclusive and inclusive and extractive methods of governing. The New World Order is nothing but a disinformation lie spread through the alternate media to cover up the fact that our societies are currently ruled or dominated by an old world order, that same old world which has been pulling strings of our government for over a century. On previous shows, I have spoken to and talked to the Federal Reserve Act and how it was contrived and forced on the American people very surreptitiously, very sneakily. Proof of this assertion comes in the form of a book, The Economic Pinch, was written by Charles Lindbergh Sr. in 1924, not to be confused with his son, Aviator. Lindbergh Sr. was a Republican congressman and an unknown hero in this era. As noted in a previous piece, he is purported to have presented the Banker's Manifesto of 1892 to the U.S. Congress sometime between 1907 and 1917. Lindbergh himself identifies the old world order, which already ruled our societies in his era. And here's a quote from it, I believe. Shortly after the American Civil War, a group of men formed a selfish plan to rule the world by the manipulation of finances. There you go. Regular readers of this article that Jeff is in the throes of writing are very familiar with this cabal, which seeks to rule the world by the manipulation of finances and know it today as the One Bank, the One Bank being the IMF or the World Bank. Lindbergh labels the members of this cabal profiteers. And herein, I would remind you of how we differentiate the words profiteering and prosperity. It is in alignment with the law of economy and the law of attraction that prosperity is every individual's rightful heritage. And as we delude ourselves into thinking, or as we pervert our belief that having material wealth more than we need, this is where we dive off a cliff as into profiteering. Nearly 100 years ago, he warned the world of the current peril posed by the profiteers of an old world order. Another quote. So far as the profiteers go, there is but one hope for them, not that they will save themselves, but that the people will take action to save the people from the impending peril of the super wealthy gone wealth crazy. There is an aspect here that the wealthy are getting wealthier and wealthier, and the rest of the people are losing their wealth. Lindbergh is very explicit that even in his own era, the economic oppression imposed by the psychopaths of the old world order was already worse than the oppression which existed in pre-revolutionary times, when the United States was nothing but a colony of the British Empire. So if we take into account the conditions of the people, we see more injustice imposed by the profiteers and politicians of these times than is stated in the Declaration of Independence against the imperial government we were then under. He also explicitly stated clear that the U.S. two-party dictatorship frequently described or alluded to in various things of this world and controlled by the old world order are already a reality in his own era. Again, a quote from Lindbergh's piece, there is no material difference now in the old political parties except which shall control patronage. It is with the knowledge that the new normal and the new world order are nothing but propaganda fiction, and we are ruled by the same old world order today, which ruled us 100 years ago, that we can look back to Lindbergh's time and Lindbergh himself for new ideas on how we can fight back against this oppression. The interesting irony in all of this is one of the quotes that Rothschild once said, and he said, give me control of a nation's money, and I care not who makes its rules, because I can through the use of money, the illusion was. Now, the starting point here is to refer to Lindbergh's own economic paradigm. He states that our societies are roughly broken down into four groups. A, the three useful groups, and B, the one useless group. He describes the three useful groups as the farmer, the wage worker, and the business group, which we would today call small business. Naturally, the one useless group is the profiteers, economic parasites, who create or produce nothing themselves, but leech all of the wealth out of the society to appease their own insatiable greed. Here, Lindbergh identifies an economic truth which is oblivious to all of the charlatans of our own era who have the audacity to call themselves economists. He points out that the three useful groups share strong mutual interest. Here we go again, collaboration. Specifically, it is in the best interests of each group that all three groups be prosperous. There's the word prosperous again. There's the word prosperity again. If the farmer is prosperous, he or she can produce abundant crops at reasonable prices. If the wage worker is prosperous, he or she will tend to be well-educated, well-dressed, and generally more productive employee. If the small business group is prosperous, it can hire more workers or even pay its wage workers higher wages, which they will then spend buying the crops of the farmer and the goods of the small businesses. It is only the one useless group, the bankers, the profiteers, whose selfish interests are contrary to the interests of all other groups. Thus, he notes, the three useful groups can, should, or must unite to collectively promote and represent their enormous mutual interests. Already in Lindbergh's time, the old world order was heavily involved in dividing and conquering politics. It continually attempted to drive political economic wedges between these groups in a never-ending effort to manufacture antagonism, or at least mistrust, between these three useful groups. Already in Lindbergh's time, there were independent associations of one form or another by which the three useful groups sought to separately promote their own interests. Again, the old aspect of divide and conquer. Extractive versus inclusive. As go we, so go I. I cannot say this enough. But already in Lindbergh's time, these associations had been infiltrated and or corrupted by the old world order. Thus, not only are those associations unsuccessful at collectively protecting the interests of the three useful groups, they were or are completely ineffectual in even representing their interests individually. I would point out here that the lobbying industry for the financial community, they have more lobbyists than there are congressmen or senators in the U.S. It was time, Lindbergh declared in 1924, for a new idea, a new way of doing things, a new federation, the three useful groups uniting in a collective federation to collectively promote their mutual interests. Or, to steal a line from Alexandre Dumas, one for all and all for one, which was in the Three Musketeers. Our phrase is, as go we, so go I. It is because the three useful groups have always sought to promote their interests separately that it has been so easy for the puppet masters of the old world order to play their game of divide and conquer. Conversely, a larger united federation would or could not only do a better job of protecting the individual interests of the three useful groups, it would also, for the first time, promote their collective interests. In our own corrupt paradigm, it is only the one useless group which is united. Its vehicle for our political economic oppression and the parasitic looting of our societies is the one bank. Standing against this political economic oppression on behalf of the three useful groups, we have nothing. Our governments, our representatives, are nothing but paid stooges of the one bank. Our individual associations, which represent the three useful groups, are weak, ineffectual, and often corrupt as well. With representations inside the political system now nothing but a hollow joke, the three useful groups, who collectively represent the vast majority of our societies, need to organize themselves outside of the current corrupt political framework. United we stand, divided we fall. It's already far, far too late to prevent an economic fall of monumental proportions. The one bank, the old world order, has already crippled and hollowed out our present economic system and even our political social infrastructure to such a grievous extent that with its systematic plundering that an economic day of reckoning is now inevitable. Boy, you've heard me say that on more than one occasion now, have you? It isn't a function of if, it's merely a function of when. What is of paramount importance as we approach this inevitable precipice is that control of our economies, governments, and societies no longer remains solely in the hands of the same cabal of psychopathic oligarchs who have nearly completed the destruction of the wealthiest, most prosperous societies our species has ever built. We need the new federation, which Charles Lindbergh Sr. described or explained to us over 90 years ago, not to protect the societies we have built and the wealth we have amassed. The old world order is already destroyed and stolen that, respectively. We need a new federation. So when these psychopaths have reduced our current system to nothing but rubble and ashes with their rapacious looting, that we can build something better in its place. Now this brings us back to previous conversations in the fact that the system in place right now is so broken and is so compromised and is so overwrought with greed that we cannot dig our way out of this currently occurring collapse using the same system. We cannot do the same thing and expect different results. The self-serving, self-aggrandizement of the old world order, as Jeff would make reference to, has run its course. This is an ending of an era. This is where greed, the effects of greed, and what greed has put in place, the causes, now come back to wreak havoc on a system that has been compromised. Good old law of karma, good old law of cause and effect. You cannot let greed run unfettered and unchecked forever. Sorry, it just comes back and changes. It evolves. We are stepping into a new system where people will realize unequivocally the phrase, as go we, so go I. Let us wake up to that, please, and thank you. Let us recognize that our wealth is in peril if you are still involved in the stock market, if you are still involved with expecting that the powers that be have your best interests in mind. They don't. Their only predisposition is to empower and enrich themselves at your expense. Now, reasonably consistent message that we've been playing for this past several years, in fact. There is an economy right now that needs tending. The economy is in the throes of collapsing. There is manner of events that are happening already right now that give us great pause. Things are not getting better. Things are in the process of collapsing. Now, is this normal? It is normal given the causes of this collapse. Is it time to recognize a new system may need to be put in place? Yes. Is it time to embrace the old aspect of as go we, so go I? Yeah. We have a propagation of memes as everybody is in it for themselves, and this has never led to prosperity, and it has never led to continuity or compliance with the big laws. Let us be ever mindful of this. And with that, ladies and gentlemen, this is Jeff Dunphy. This is Retooling for Our Coming of Age. And I would like very much to thank you for the opportunity to be of service in turning on the lights. And I would also like to thank you for your attention. And I look forward to speaking with you next week. Goodbye.